Welcome to Beth Tikkun and this series called Spiritual Seasons, where we are exploring the Torah portions in the light of God's yearly spiritual curriculum tied to the calendar. This week we are in Parsha Teruma, Exodus chapters 25 to 27. Let's begin with a summary of the portion. So after the sundry laws of Parsha Mishpatim, Teruma starts with, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me from every man whose heart moves him. You shall raise my contribution." God then describes the kinds of materials Israel is to collect, which include gold, silver, and bronze, fine fabrics, hides, and precious stones. In chapter 25, 8 and 9, God says, "Let them construct a sanctuary for me, that I may dwell among them. According to all that I am going to show you, as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furniture, just so you shall construct it." God then describes three pieces of furniture, the Ark of the Covenant, the table of showbread, and the menorah. Next, he describes the curtains with their loops and clasps, then the boards and sockets, then the veil, and the doorway screen. Finally, for Teruma, we have descriptions of the bronze altar and the court. Rabbi Trugman points out that the Torah takes a pretty radical turn here. So up until now, we have mostly been reading stories, one after the next. Starting with Teruma, about the next third of the Torah centers on building the tabernacle and what happens inside the tabernacle, like the sacrificial system. And it only has a few stories scattered throughout this text. In fact, the tabernacle and the functioning of the tabernacle is given the most space of any topic in the Torah. And it might seem odd to have so much of God's holy text taken up with all these details of building this elaborate tent. Once we start getting into the sacrificial system in Leviticus, our modern sensibilities are even more befuddled. Like, what's going on here? Why are we reading this now, is the question. So one very useful lens we have absorbed from Grant over the years is that God emphasizes what is especially important to him. And if it's important to him, then it's important to us too. We need to pay close attention to what God gives literal space to in the Torah. If something like this major shift in the Torah strikes us as odd, then we need to recognize that we're missing something important. One difference in the Jewish and Messianic perspective of the word versus at least what I was brought up with is the fundamental assumption that there is absolutely nothing in the word that is anachronistic or out of date. All that it speaks to us, it speaks to all of us throughout all of time and history and place. All of it is important. What might throw us off here is the level of specific detail we are being given for a building that doesn't exist anymore, at least not in the open. So interestingly, the rabbis say that, and they're pretty insistent that the actual tabernacle exists still, and it's below the Temple Mount in caves, and that one day it will be taken out, and everyone will kind of look at it and marvel. But we don't have it now with us in the open. So great attention to detail is an aspect of increased physicality. And this attention to detail is something we experience as we near the end of the cycle of salvation. So we'll see that in the Purim story, right? Purim is coming up here in a couple weeks. And right at the beginning of that story in Esther, it has this elaborate description of the king's party and, you know, the different kinds of furniture and fabrics and all of that. That's all that detail is what you run into at the end of the cycle of salvation. But what I want to say here is that all of that great detail is a mask for great spirituality. In other words, the increased spirituality is often reflected outwardly as elaborate physical detail. They go hand in hand. And so if we are able to not knee-jerk against the detail and trust that something massive and truly weighty is moving underneath these details, then we can start to open up the package and see the brilliant light inside. There's simply much more going on here than what's on the surface. This section of the Torah encompasses the whole middle section of the Torah. In the middle is, you know, the shamash. It's the what everything else hangs on. So one way we need to approach these chapters is as a roadmap for living with God in our midst, a picture of what it looks like when we reach a kind of end goal in our relationship with the Creator of the universe. These are literally central chapters that not only teach us how to live with God, but also with each other. As we learn about God dwelling with his people, we are also learning about how we dwell with each other. And of course, as with everything else in creation, every detail of these chapters is teaching us about Yeshua. I'm not going to pretend that I can explain all of that detail and how what this represents and what that represents. But these are just guiding principles that we need to keep with us as we are reading through these chapters, that they are the surface details that are masking a wealth of spiritual light beneath them. So one reason that I believe we are to lift up these chapters particularly high is that we start reading them each year in the final month of the year, Adar. In years with two Adars, we are reading quite a large chunk of this section of the Torah during Adar, either Adar 1 or Adar 2. Coming to the final month of the year means that we are reaching a concluding level of maturity for this yearly cycle, the 12th step upward out of 12 steps. So there is a relationship between this topic of the tabernacle and the spiritual and physical maturity. Let me just give now a few of the many themes connected to end stages and end times we need to be keeping an eye out for as we read through and study these portions and as we walk through the holiday of Purim this year. We'll have time to elaborate on many of these as we continue in the weeks to come. For now, let me just list them. You know, there are many more, but some of these end of cycle themes include, firstly, the ultimate revelation of God's good plan. This is something we run into at the end, the ultimate revelation of God's good plan. In the Purim story, this takes the form of a sudden reversal where everything looks lost until suddenly it flips. So we see a flipping at the end in this revelation. Number two, man's greatest chance to express his free will. So we've said all along that with increasing maturity comes increasing free will. And that has to do with God's increasing hiddenness as we approach the end. Number three, if we are clinging to faith, then we should expect to experience our point of greatest spiritual development at the end. And this goes along with a point of greatest physical development. So in our context, physical development doesn't mean you get huge. Physical development mostly means that with God's help, we have developed practical vessels for giving of ourselves to the world around us. Practical, physical vessels for giving away our life. That's what physical development means. So fourthly, as we approach the end, we should see great connection to God and others. So connection is life. And as we mature, we are more and more connected to everyone and everything around us. Number five, we should expect to see a chance to witness evangelistically. So this could be evangelism with or without words, right? Sometimes it's just with our actions, our example. We should expect God to be helping us to distribute his light and salvation to those who are crying out for it, who are thirsty for it. Sometimes he does this by putting us in a vice and squeezing us while others are looking on to see how we handle ourselves. So that squeezing is also part of the end. Sixth, we should see a great potential for either depression on the one hand or joy on the other. And that depends on where we are holding and how we are approaching the end. Part of the increasing paradox we have with this time of year is that it naturally lends itself to depression. But in the Lord, this time of year lends itself to depression. But in the Lord, it becomes a season of great joy. And they say that the season of Purim is the highest joy in the year, even higher than Simchat Torah, which is named for joy. So this is a phenomenon of great potential for either depression or joy. This phenomenon is something that the elderly among us can identify with and teach us about, right? As we age, we tend to go one direction or the other, into that depression or into joy. So seventh, we should expect to see hints of the new beginning to come soon. So the sages say that the end is enwedged in the beginning. The end spills over into the beginning, and the beginning spills over into the end, like a dragon catching its tail or something. So as the end approaches, a new light is already beginning to rise on a new spiritual year. The final month of the year contains a great redemption. And this redemption is linked to the redemption of Nisan, the first month of the next year. So when there are two Adars, Purim is in the second Adar, because that redemption of Adar, of Purim, is to be linked to the one in the following month, which is Nisan. There's a connection there. So these seven themes are just the first that came into my mind as I sat down to think about ending themes, end time themes. But there are many more, as I said. But all of these are themes of both Purim and the whole final month of Adar, which we have just begun, right, just a couple days ago. Purim is right in the middle of the month, the full moon of the month of Adar. So Purim is expressing ideas central to this month. This year, right, that we're in now, 2023, Purim is going to start on a Monday evening, and that's March 6th. Just a heads up there. So last month's full moon in the middle of the month was Tu B'Shvat, the new year for trees. This month, the full moon is Purim. And next month, the full moon is going to be Passover. So there's much to say about the month of Adar beyond these end time themes. But for today, I want to focus on the name Adar, which has a strong link to Parsha Terumah. The word Adar in Hebrew means to be great, majestic, wide, or expansive, or noble. It is also connected to the word Adir, which means strength and power. So these are all important and related meanings in themselves. They all have to do with the month of Adar. But the sages do something else with this word. They separate the Aleph at the beginning from the other two letters, yielding Aleph Dar. This means Aleph dwells. So Dar means to dwell. The Aleph refers to God. So this meaning of the word is God dwells. It is in the month of Adar that we witness some kind of culmination of the process of God coming to dwell among us. So we can see an immediate connection now to our Torah portion in this way of understanding the word Adar as God dwells, or the Aleph dwells, since this is the portion that begins to introduce the description of God's dwelling on earth, the tabernacle. As we discuss the tabernacle, let's always keep in mind that in the end, this is a house. It's God's house. So we're seeing the theme of the house coming from multiple angles here. God dwells, the Aleph dwells, and Parsha Teruma and the Torah portions to come about the tabernacle. So let's now turn to the Torah portion. The ancient Midrash Tanhuma famously says that the ultimate purpose of all of creation, including all levels of creation, high and low, is that God desired a dwelling in the lowest of all the worlds. So God desires a home here among us in the lowest world. Throughout the Bible, we're reading about how he is accomplishing this, how he's coming to earth, this lowest realm. Though through much of the beginning of the Exodus story, God is reintroducing himself to humanity after the fall and many centuries of relative darkness. To Moses, his messenger, he presents himself rather near, right? He's the burning bush, and he's talking right to him. So he's pretty close to Moses. But once he has Moses as his mouthpiece in this reintroduction to humanity process, he presents himself at first as mighty and high and removed and separated from mankind. He is literally high, high up there, right, after this encounter with Moses. The plagues consecutively show that God is master of the lowest places and then the middle places and then the highest places, showing that he's higher than the water, higher than the land, even higher than the sky and the heavenly bodies. Eventually, he shows himself as a towering pillar of cloud and fire, and then he appears on the top of a mountain, Mount Sinai. So again, high up there. Here now in Teruma, we begin to see the plan for coming down from the mountain. God's desire is not just to dwell in the earth. What he really wants is to dwell in people, both individually and especially in our communities. We're going to take a little time and talk about that. It's not really about the tabernacle. It's about dwelling in the people. We are the home he desires, but we have to be a holy vessel for a holy God to dwell within us. So there's some work to be done, and God is patient to work with us to do it. God doesn't force his way into anyone or a community. He wants a bride who chooses him from her own free will. So he quietly helps us to cleanse our vessel and construct a holy home within and among ourselves. We're given that thrilling privilege of teaming up with him to make the home. And God pictures all this in the building of the tabernacle. The building of the tabernacle is, on a certain level, a kind of culmination of this process of God working with humanity to create a clean and holy community within which he makes his home, dwelling in our midst. At the very end of the Bible, we see another picture of this idea that God dwells in people. And that kind of indwelling is reflected as a physical home for God. In the book of Revelation, we read in chapter 21 the following verses, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away." So the bride is the people among whom God dwells, but what we see as a physical representation of the people is a city, the New Jerusalem. The real thing is the community. The reflection is the city. So as we're reading in these chapters about constructing the tabernacle and the garments of the priests and how they are to perform sacrifices and how tithes and first fruits are to be brought and all the rest of the activities there, keep in mind that the tabernacle itself and even all the activity that is there is not really the main goal. The goal is the relationship with the people. And this is what the prophets keep telling the people when they slide into doing their sacrifices by rote, right? Not with the fullness of their heart. The prophets keep saying that God wants a relationship with them. It's not about the sacrifices, right? He wants their heart. So the idea that God could even want a physical home seems rather confusing to us. Can God fit into a home made by man's hands? Can mankind really construct a home for God? The tabernacle was two rooms, about 45 foot by 15 foot, or 675 square feet. That's even smaller than my own little house. Now, make no mistake, the tabernacle is the image of a heavenly tabernacle, which is really spectacular, surely. But when we're talking about an infinite God, any dwelling, no matter how big and fabulous, is simply a speck. The tabernacle must be fitted to a holy God according to the best that the people can do at that time. But God's real aim is relationship. He wants to dwell in the people. And we can see that a person and a community are indeed fitting dwellings for God. One of the things we will see in the following chapters is that in giving the people this challenge of building this amazing little building perfectly suited to their traveling needs and using the best of the materials they have available at the time and giving them this construction challenge, the people have to come together and be bonded into a community as never before. So it is partly in the process of making God a physical dwelling that they become a suitable community to dwell within. The two go hand in hand. The fusing of the people and the building of the physical building. As the tabernacle is built, we see them becoming a giving, cooperative, creative, and fruitful people. And that's what God wants to live among. Notice that the name of this important Torah portion is not tabernacle. The name is teruma. This word teruma is focused more on the people than the structure. Teruma means contribution or offering or donation. It is from a root that means to lift up. And as the people lower themselves down to lift up these donations, as they say, this is what they say. They say, this is better used for God's house rather than for me. I would rather give this for God's use than for me to use it in my life. And as they do that, as they lower themselves like that, they will be lifted up, becoming the people among whom the God of the universe dwells. So the point I want to make here is that we can see in the name of the portion the essence of what makes the people a proper dwelling place. What makes them a dwelling place is their cooperative giving, right? Their donation. They are to give of their precious things. They are to give of what looks like their future security, their retirement fund. They are to give of their hard-won compensation for years, years of Egyptian slavery. What did they get paid over that time? Well, in the end, they took out all this rich stuff. They are to give of that which gives them pleasure and beautifies them, right? Their earrings, their necklaces with the precious stones. It is in this kind of self-sacrifice that we become a dwelling for God. Again, the portion is not named for the tabernacle. It's named for what makes the people into a home for God, this giving, because this home among the people is God's real goal. I want to cap off this idea in one more way today by looking at a peculiar Hebrew phrasing in teruma, an idiom God uses in Exodus 26. So this is an idea that I first heard from Devorah Berkowitz years ago. The section is describing the linen curtains, which make up the innermost layer of the walls and ceiling. They are to be interwoven with blue, purple, and scarlet, and they are to have cherubim worked into them. We don't see it in English, in the English translations, but when God describes how these linen pieces are to be joined together, the Hebrew literally reads, "The five curtains shall be joined, a woman to her sister." And five curtains joined a woman to her sister. So it repeats it there. This wording is also used a bit later when describing how the boards are fitted together with the tenons. All the other uses of the word sister in Exodus are the standard use of sister, most of them applying to Moses' sister Miriam. The Hebrew here is bringing out the point that on a certain level, the tabernacle is a reflection of the people, like the New Jerusalem bride from Revelation. The tabernacle is partly a picture of Israel. When it is upgraded to a permanent temple, this indicates a higher level for the people. You know, when it's in tatters, that's a reflection too of the people. The people, in a way, are in tatters when the tabernacle is in tatters. So God desires to dwell in people, and our homes, our tabernacle, our synagogue, our church is, in a way, a reflection of what's going on within us, within the people, within the community. The idea of a home is a rich one. Our homes reflect us, particularly in the little details. Of all the tchotchkes and knickknacks we have the opportunity to buy and take home and decorate our homes with, we say no to thousands that, you know, we see at the stores and in the flea markets. And the ones we settle on reflect something about us. We can see a bit of what's going on inside a person by visiting their home. So it can be a little stressful to open ourselves when we open our homes to people. But in many ways, being hospitable in that way creates very strong bonds with people. They get to know you better and quite quickly when they see your home. So in connection to this idea, the final point I want to make on this topic in Teruma today is that God is calling the believing community back to the home. We're seeing this call going out here and there now, and it's too much to just be coincidence. Leaders of believing communities are hearing this call for their flocks, and there's a lot of uncomfortable discussion happening now within elder boards. You know, the little that we've heard about it is just the tip of the iceberg, but we've heard, you know, more than one locally here of elder boards trying to come to terms with this call. So this call back to the home is an important development in our times that is one more clue that we are heading into the closing of a cycle of human history, because we see this emphasis on the home here as the cycle is closing out, as we're seeing reflected in the Torah portions at the end of the year. God is shaking the kahal, the church. And part of that shaking is the testing of a certain call, the call to return to the home. He's shaking the whole world, of course, but that's just beginning. In this early phase of the birth pains, he's doing a special shaking in the church, a testing that is meant to refine and prepare the body for the much greater upheavals to come. And talking with Colleen in South Africa, they're also feeling this shaking there in their community. And it's obvious. It's not subtle. So now, if God were going to shake the kahal, the believing community, how would he communicate that? So yesterday I was reading, I mean, obviously he communicates it because we can feel it. We can feel people leaving us who we've known with us for a long time. We can feel splits. We can feel it in many ways, but God is creative. He has many ways to communicate to us any given idea. So yesterday I was reading in Acts, and I happened to read Acts 11, 25 to 26, and it says this: "So Barnabas went to Tarsus to look for Saul, and when he found him, he brought him to Antioch. For a whole year they met with the church and taught a great many people. And in Antioch, the disciples were first called Christians." In other words, the city of Antioch has a very special place in the history of the apostolic era of God's people. It is there, we're believers, are first called Christians, little Christs or little Messiahs. The Bible pauses in the book of Acts to make note of this development because it's meaningful. If you've been watching the news lately, you might have seen that there was another large earthquake in Turkey last Monday, magnitude 6.3. The epicenter was just a little southwest of the ancient city of Antioch, which is now called Antakya. Antioch was one of the closest big cities to that last quake, and it suffered terrible damage from the two huge earlier quakes that were in that region of Turkey. It's on the same fault system that runs through Antioch, where those two big earlier ones were. Areas of Antioch were completely flattened in those earthquakes. We could call this a coincidence, but I don't believe I don't believe in coincidences. He's testing our allegiances. He's testing our willingness to humbly submit to the spiritual authority he has set over us. He's testing our willingness to be obedient, even if we were more comfortable with some other way of communing together on Shabbat. So in the midst of these early birth pains, I say to BT, keep going, you're doing great. And we're seeing the fruit of obedience. Our corporate times together with everyone, they are important. It's wonderful to worship all together as a large body. It strengthens us. But at the same time, there are a lot of moving pieces to coordinate on those days. And people sometimes slip through the cracks. What I'm seeing develop now with BT is that we are finding ways to meet in smaller, more intimate groups. The women are meeting regularly, and the men will be meeting regularly now. There's another group that is forming around the twice monthly Erevs at the building, and of course we have our home fellowships. Each of these is an environment that lends itself better to real conversation and real connection than a large mixed group does. Though that large group also has advantages, God is truly helping us to go deeper with each other, and it's wonderful to see, and that deeper connection is a quality of end times. So let's turn now to a brief application of today's discussion directly to Yeshua. Obviously, there is a clear connection between Yeshua and the tabernacle. What is God's ultimate means of dwelling among us? He does so through Yeshua, who is described as tabernacling among us. So we can see in John's use of the word tabernacle, he tabernacled among us, both a reference to Sukkot, which is the likely time of his incarnation, and also this very tabernacle that we're just beginning to see described in this Torah portion. Yeshua is called God with us. So this main connection between Yeshua and the tabernacle is somewhat obvious, but I want to take a minute and briefly connect Yeshua to the tabernacle in a less obvious way. We want to go beneath the surface a bit because there's a great spiritual light there under these physical details, as we said earlier. And as I was thinking about this yesterday, and this particular insight began to swim into view, I was quite amazed at what I was seeing. You know, I call these things God's poetry. So here it is. We could say that there are five main pieces of furniture in the tabernacle: the Ark of the Covenant, the table of showbread, the menorah, the golden altar of incense, and the bronze altar. The kinor, where they wash, is kind of treated separately in the text, and it's kind of a little more preparatory function for the laver. That's the word I was looking for. So we're going to talk about five here. Yeshua has clear connections to all of these. All that they hold or produce is pictured by Yeshua. In other words, Yeshua is the goal and purpose for all of these pieces of furniture. So let's see how this is, you know, quickly. The Ark of the Covenant contains the covenant, the tablets, which are the summary of the Torah. And Yeshua is called the Word made flesh. And the new covenant hinges on him in every way, right? So we've got the ark, we've got the covenant, Yeshua is the Word made flesh. The table of showbread has 12 loaves of bread stacked on it. Yeshua is called the bread of life. The menorah makes light. Yeshua is called the light of the world. And for the two altars, the golden altar and the bronze altar, Yeshua is the perfect offering. He's called the Lamb of God. And, you know, which is this sweet-smelling aroma, the sweet-smelling sacrificial aroma, is the sinless one. So the writer of Hebrews even says that the veil between the Holy of Holies and the holy place represents Yeshua's flesh. So further, Grant often would point out to us, particularly in relation to the elements of the holy place, that, you know, the holy place, that the first chamber that's enclosed entirely, you've got the holy place and then the Holy of Holies. And so Grant would often tell us about the holy place that each element requires a kind of breaking. But this breaking is an element of all of the services attached to each piece of furniture, also in the courtyard and also in the Holy of Holies. So the sacrifices of the outer court, right, are sacrificed on the bronze altar. They are slaughtered and burned on that bronze altar. And so that's a breaking of the animal, the slaughtering and burning. The wheat for the bread in the holy place is crushed and burned. The olives for the menorah's oil are crushed and burned. The ingredients for the incense are dried out and crushed and burned. Even the tablets in the Ark of the Covenant are first broken, the breaking of the first set of the tablets. It's quite a picture of what happens to Yeshua as Yeshua, on behalf of mankind, is brought to a place of fruitfulness and light and sustenance like the bread and conveyance of wisdom like through his ministry, the tablets. So what do these connections mean? Why is this happening in God's house? I suppose, you know, it's something that we need to ponder for a long time. But I think one thing it means is that if our homes reflect something deep of our essence, and they do, then we can conclude from the tabernacle that deep within God's essence is the desire to share himself with us in the form of his Son. He offers him on the altar. He offers him on the table of showbread. He offers him through the burning of the oil to make light. He offers his blood as the proof and foundation of the covenant. All these activities at God's home are not just for him. They're not just for God. They are God giving of himself for us who are invited to come to his house and be his guest. It is to be a house of worship for all nations. There's something especially deep happening here that we would do well to continue thinking into as we continue exploring in these coming Torah portions. So lastly, now let's turn to the book of Joshua in chapter 11 in Joshua, which so wonderfully illustrates especially what is happening in the calendar in the second half of the year. Right? Joshua taking the land, I've been connecting that especially to the second half of the year, and so far, especially to the cleansing of the vessel, and the cleansing of the land. So in Joshua 11, we continue to read about that cleansing process for the body. Israel is inheriting the land. Joshua 11 is the record of the northern campaign of the taking of Canaan. With the capture of the north, the conquest of the land is complete, though there remain some Canaanites that each tribe will need to battle individually to remove. It's like they experience victory together as a group, and then God requires each piece to rise up and do what the whole nation had done collectively, make battle on your own. Unlike the southern campaign, which was quick, the text tells us that Joshua battled the northern kings for a long time. But what kicks it all off is one king who rallies the northern kings together to come against Israel. And his name is Yabin, king of Hazor, or Hazor. I'll say Hazor. He gathers together a vast army to come against Joshua and Israel, described as a great horde like the sand of the seashore. God says to Joshua, "Don't be afraid of them. Tomorrow, I'll give them over to you dead. Hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire." Apparently, what Joshua does is come upon this giant camp suddenly when they weren't expecting it, and Israel routs them. At that time, they take the city of Hazor and slay the king and all the inhabitants. It turns out that Yabin was head of all these surrounding kings. Joshua burns Hazor to the ground, unlike the other cities on mounds that will be conquered in the north. For the remaining cities, the people are killed, but the cities are not burned. The point I want to make here is that Yeshua leads us in cleaning out the house before God comes to dwell in it. And some parts are simply irredeemable. They have to be burned to the ground. Like we said earlier, God requires a clean and holy vessel to dwell in, and he leads us through that cleansing process. We experience a new level of this every year according to a pattern. Here we see Joshua leading the people in a second phase of cleansing the land, the northern lands this time. And under Joshua's leading, the people are able to salvage a lot of the infrastructure of the land, most of it, in fact. The inhabitants are killed, and we can assume that the people contain within them, the Canaanites, contain within them some kind of unclean spirit that can only be purged completely with death. But most of the cities are kept for Israel to re-inhabit. The city walls and buildings and cisterns and vineyards along with the livestock. But there are rare times in this cleansing process when God or Joshua says, "We won't save this one. Burn it down all the way to the ground." We saw this at Jericho in the south, and we see it here again with Hazor in the north. So who is this king that must be so thoroughly annihilated that even his city must be burned? Yabin means intelligence, and Hazor, or intelligent, Hazor means castle and comes from a root that means to enclose. And how many intelligent people are trapped in their castles, both intellectual and physical castles? They are so smart that they've explained away a creator. They are so smart that they've created a self-sufficiency to where they don't need community. They are so smart that they turn up their nose at half the world and can't get along with the other half. Too often, intelligence simply leads to pride, and pride is a root evil in humanity. It cannot be tolerated. Pride must be shown no mercy. Even the empty rooms built by pride and human-centered reasoning and humanism are tainted. Burn them down. As we go about cleansing our vessel, there are many rooms that can stay and be put to holy uses. Intellectual pride is not one of them. Well, we'll end it there today. Thank you for watching. I've posted an outline below the video. May God open up these important portions to us as never before. And may we see in him these portions. In these portions, God, and may we see his heart of love in these details of the tabernacle. May we be a people who God is proud to dwell among. May we be a hospitable people who open our homes generously. And may we be a vigilant and brave people who are not afraid to burn to the ground what does not belong in us. And may he make us fully into the people he wants us to be. Shalom.